Hey, it's Francis Lamb, host of The Splendid Table. Every week on our show, we talk about food and cooking and the meanings of food and cooking. We talk with the most interesting people in food about their techniques, their culture, and everything in between. Whether it's about how fried chicken took over the world or how Instagram changes the way people are actually eating. It's a food show where everyone is welcome. Come join us. You can listen to The Splendid Table wherever you get your podcasts.
Today's program is proudly brought to you by Whole Foods Market. Visit wholefoodsmarket.com or download the Whole Foods Market app to learn more and find the store nearest to you.
You're listening to Heritage Radio Network. We're a member-supported food radio network broadcasting over 35 weekly shows live from Bushwick, Brooklyn. Join our hosts as they lead you through the world of craft brewing, behind the scenes of the restaurant industry, inside the battle over school food, and beyond. Find us at heritageradionetwork.org.
Hello out there. This is Amanda.
This is Kim.
And we...
We haven't seen each other in a minute.
Yeah. Can we do that? David, can we start again?
Well, this is live, so no.
Okay, pretend the music just played again. Hello! What's up, Internet?
I'm Amanda.
And I'm Kim.
And we are Food Book Fair, and you're listening to Recommended Reading with Food Book Fair, our weekly show where we get to download with friends and fam in the industry and beyond about what they're reading, watching, or listening to. Food Book Fair is an annual food media festival celebrating writing about eating, and we're thrilled to be celebrating 6 years, going on 7 in New York, and hopefully bringing Food Book Fair to your city very soon.
We also do green market book signings in collaboration with Grow NYC. We do other events around the calendar year, often in partnership and collaboration with other cool folks in New York City especially. And we're really excited to have later on in our show our special guests, the chefs Amani Ahmad and Aura Wise, talking about a Palestinian pop-up series they're doing next week with a host of other collaborators at Dimes and Lolito in downtown New York, November 13th and 14th. And we'll get to them in a little bit. But first, Amanda, what are you reading, watching, and listening to?
Oh, I've waited so long to hear those words from you, Kim, but I'm sorry.
You guys are adorable.
We've just taken breaks every other week, though, so it's not like we've been apart that long. But
that's true.
I also see on the table that we're both still reading the same issue of the New York Times magazine.
Which was the first thing that I was going to talk about. I think we're a week late, I think. This was from last week's magazine section, but we've been busy. And it's the part that I'm really loving reading is a profile and recipes to go with it of five cool people's dinner parties. And each one talks about how they would host their dinner party, what their philosophy is about dinner parties, who they would invite, and then there's recipes. I'm working my way through right now. I'm reading Dory Greenspan's right now, the pastry chef and author. And what I really loved about this was just reminding me that just have people over and cook and share what you love to do and get inspiration from wherever you encounter inspiration from. And it just like made me want to put a date on the calendar and invite my friends over and get cooking. And then after I started reading this, I listened to the Bon Appetit podcast with Adam Rappaport and Allison Roman, the author. She has a new book called Dining In.
Mm-hmm.
And Allison said, don't think about it as entertaining. Think about it as just having people over. And I was like, yeah. That's it. It's sometimes when you think about entertaining, it's like you get stressed.
It's a little bit what Tejal Rao and Sam Sifton say in both of their essays in the same issue of the New York Times Magazine, where it's like you happen to be cooking and then people come over.
Don't think about it more than that.
But do maybe plan in advance or figure out something you don't have to plan that far in advance.
Fondue.
I'm a big fondue advocate. It does come up in Tatel's column.
Oh, yeah. Tatel's is about fondue. And then she had a crazy technique for the end. I'm trying to remember what it was. You like take...
Is it the thing with the egg?
Oh, the egg! I've never heard of that.
If you're still hungry at the end of a pot of fondue, this is not a spoiler for people that regularly eat fondue, or maybe are friends with Tatel Rao, and if you are, call us. Crack an egg in the bottom once you've scraped all the cheese out, but there's a little bit left, and then it'll cook from the residual heat, and then you can use the potatoes and bread to scoop up whatever there is left, if you're still hungry.
Hashtag fondue hacks. I've got to try that. I loved reading about that. And then the other thing that I have not been able to stop reading is an article by the chef owner of Dirt Candy, Amanda Cohen, that was published on Esquire, that she wrote about really as a call to action to the press and calling them out on the fact that they've given recently attention to so many female chefs because female chefs are starting to share their stories about harassment and unfair treatment in kitchens that they have worked in. And Amanda is saying, like, of course I don't stand for an unjust workplace, and I want anyone who's been unfairly treated to come forward. But why are female chefs only getting this type of attention when it has to do with their stories? And why hasn't the press consistently written about them, awarded them with honor, and kept them in the headlines because of their work? And it's a really serious call out to the press, and I highly recommend everyone read it. And thank you, Amanda, for writing it.
I gotta check it out.
Please
do. I see it in my inbox. I can't wait till we no longer live in a world dominated by cis-heteropatriarchy and we have a majority-minority country.
Well,
that comes in 2016.
It's crumbling.
We'll see what comes after that.
That's Aura Wise getting on the mic over there, everyone. She's fired up.
So maybe this is a good time for us to introduce our guests.
Let's do it.
Again, we are joined today by the chef and artist Amani Ahmad, the chef and community organizer and good friends of ours, Aura Wise. Excited to talk to them about a series called The Asymmetrical Table, which is two nights of dinners and dialogue, thought-provoking and delicious, at Dimes in Lolito next Monday and Tuesday. And it will be talking about, the dinners are about food sovereignty here and everywhere, but we'll be talking about that right here, right now as well. Welcome to the show.
Thank you.
We're so happy to have you on. Can you give a little bit of an introduction of each of you in your own words? Amani, some folks in food, in and around food, and who know of your work as an artist, but maybe also as a chef, may have heard or have even attended your pop-ups that you did at Dimes earlier this summer.
Yeah, that was a really fun, exciting series that I did in July and August that was just about bringing Palestinian food to the consciousness of people that enjoy eating food. I think most people are used to eating a lot of the food that I grew up eating in Palestine and in America, cooked by my family under the moniker of Israeli food, and I just feel like it's important to reframe the conversation, and I wanted to use those dinners as an opportunity to present that information in a way that was exciting and delicious and interesting. So, yeah.
Cool. We're really glad that happened, and I was really lucky to be able to dine there with Aura one night, which think is sort of how we all met.
Yeah, that's where we found you. Well, I was stalking you.
It's true. Aura came and after she ate, she gave me a lovely gift of spices from our friend Ethan, who has a burlap and barrel where he sources beautiful spices. And we're using those in the dinners on Monday and Tuesday. But it was really sweet to have an unknown guest come and bring a gift to me. So it was lovely. That's how we all met.
Hospitality from both sides.
Yes, beautiful thing.
Aura, you're up.
I know how to talk to the ladies.
She does.
And yeah, actually, for those of you who come to the dinner at Dimes on Monday the 13th, we're going to have a little treat from Burlap and Barrel for everyone to get to maybe even play with on their own. So check that out.
That sounds great.
Yeah, there's spices that he sources from a co-op near Jenin in Palestine. So I am a chef and have actually been involved in Palestine solidarity work since I was a teenager, because I was born in Jerusalem and was raised really ignorant of what was going on there, and then re-educated myself, and then have been involved in sovereignty in general and now food sovereignty stuff. So I was so excited to learn about Amani's dinners here, because until then I had been like reading books, which I know I see on the table. We have two cookbooks side by side. It's perfect. We have Otolenghi and Tamimi's Jerusalem, and we have Leila El Haddad's The Gaza Kitchen Project. That one is, you know, a book that's rooted in being in Palestine with Palestinians and learning about their recipes and ingredients, and also, though, being really real about the effects of military occupation on their cuisine. You know, certain fish they can't have access to because they're the Israeli Coastal Guard won't let them go enough miles out to fish, or red tahina, which is a special ingredient in Gazan cooking that won't be allowed through the borders. And I feel like that's kind of context is really missing from Jerusalem, the cookbook, and also just a lot of, like Amani is talking about, our media around Mediterranean or Middle Eastern or Israeli food in the U.S. is we're excited about the ingredients, but we know nothing about the people and the lands from which they come, and which are actually really struggling for all these reasons. So we're excited to bring you both the delicious food and some of the context, so that not just because, but so that we can all be involved in supporting people and preserving their own cultures that the cuisine is from and based in.
Yeah, I think this is something that we, all of us at this table, have talked about separately, individually, and in previous conversations. It's now that there is such an interest in where food comes from, what food origins are. People are so concerned about where a carrot comes from, or where it was grown, or what soil was grown in, but not necessarily who grew it, or who distributed it, or drove it to you, or cooked it, and for how much money.
Yeah, why do you think there has been such an interest or increased attention around quote unquote Israeli food or Middle Eastern food lately? And who are the players that are contributing to this media, you know, being available to everyone and people writing about it? And, you know, talk a little bit about maybe your work to change that and some other resources that, you know, people can read for a complete picture.
Which, of course, you can't recenter the entire conversation and hundreds of years of oppression in a radio show, but we're trying.
That's right. This is a giant step for humanity.
Yeah, I mean, I think that, like, for example, Jerusalem, the cookbook, attempts to frame Middle Eastern cooking from that region from the perspective of an Israeli chef and a Palestinian chef, though it kind of glosses over everything that is unjust about the situation. I think I've noticed, and you guys have noticed as well, that in media lately there's been a large push towards articles that address this new Israeli food trend. And I was just recently in LA, and I noticed at least 5 or 6 new Israeli or Mediterranean restaurants that aren't even touting themselves as Israeli, but the media is calling them Israeli and referencing, like, you know, shakshuka, such a classic Israeli dish, or za'atar, which, I mean, I personally am very passionate about za'atar because that's something that, like, my family has always foraged in Palestine, but we no longer have access to the land to forage za'atar, and there's also laws against foraging because the Israeli government claims that because of foraging, we're endangering different botanical species, which, I mean, I don't necessarily think is accurate after generations of foraging and that species still being abundant. But I think there's just, like, a large media push that is mostly based on ignorance and just lack of knowledge of where these things come from and who these people are that are making the food, because it's the classic story of an underdog that doesn't have access to media and doesn't have access to resources to open restaurants in the United States and open these, like, beautiful eateries in, you know, metropolitan Manhattan that are gorgeous and Instagrammable and called Palestinian. I mean, My collaborator on the dinners this week, Reem of Reem's Bakery in Oakland, has suffered a lot of backlash for opening a Middle Eastern eatery, but then lauding her Palestinian heritage and being representative of the Palestinian struggle. So there's like a really strong backlash if you embrace your Palestinianness in this world that isn't set up for that. So if you've got Reem's, but then you've got 10 Israeli eateries that don't acknowledge what the food that they're cooking is inspired by, it's pretty difficult for people to be aware of what Palestinian food is.
I think it's really important that you include the context that this world is simply not set up for people who are marginalized or who are minorities, because a lot of the times the conversations that we have about cultural appropriation that are not about food sovereignty and speaking of sovereignty, we're just talking about everyone's right to have healthy, affordable, culturally appropriate food and food that you grew up cooking, food that you grew up eating, and have that be yours in some way, whatever you mean by that. I think some of the confusion is people, it kind of becomes about chops. It becomes authenticity. It becomes about who gets to cook what. But it's not really about who gets to cook what if we live in a world where you don't necessarily have that right, even if you've inherited it and you have that emotional connection to it.
Also, the who gets to cook what conversation often centers it around restaurants and the restaurant industry, right? Mm-hmm. And so that's like an important way that all of the power dynamics mm-hmm. we're talking about play out. But there it's you know, what Imani was just bringing mm-hmm. up is like the issues and how they play out in terms of like just everyday folks in their communities. In terms of reading.
Yeah, that's what I
actually
I see Aura that, has her my her recommended reading. Ready to go.
I'm now actually, my new title is just Amani's Private Librarian. But actually, Ali Abu Nima, who's a Palestinian American writer and activist, actually 2 years ago wrote a post on the Electronic Intifada called "Why Sahla Ben Hummus Still Aren't Israeli," which will be a great lead-in for maybe Imani talking, giving us a teaser for her and Reem's menu. But also on like the positive side, not just criticizing, which we need to, but also like supporting each other and the people whose food this is. Probably a lot of people in New York know Tanarin, which is the classic Palestinian restaurant in Bay Ridge, Brooklyn, which is, you know, kind of one of the little Middle Easts of New York. Mm-hmm. And it's actually a woman chef owner, Rawia Bashara, and she has a cookbook out, which came out.
We did an event with Rawia and her daughter in 2014.
Word.
At Food Book Fair.
Yeah. Nice. So,
shout out Tanarin.
Yeah. So Olives, Lemons, and Za'atar is her cookbook. And I think that like a lot of people have Ottolenghi cookbooks as their main, a lot of white people in the UK and the US have often like, because they don't have real relationships with folks outside of their own cultures, rely on these gatekeepers or like translators. And it's how certain people who aren't from a certain culture like then position themselves well. I mean, there's tons of these people. I mean, some people we respect, right? Like Diana Kennedy or like, you know, and then even we have Andy Ricker, who's, you know, cooking in the Israeli Culinary Festival roundtables that is coinciding with our Palestinian asymmetrical table, which Imani will break down why we named it that in a second, who make, you know, a living off of kind of introducing, you know, dominant culture to a different culture's cuisine. So Rawia's cookbook is a way to like get it straight from the folks whose food it is. And it's interesting to see the differences. But that was why we were excited to come together to have a meal that was all about two Palestinian women chefs telling their own story.
Mm-hmm.
And so I want Imani to break down her brilliant title. But what inspired it was kind of that we are a part of this global movement, like you're saying, Kim, of people working for food sovereignty,
right?
Which is particularly important for people who are indigenous and have been either displaced from their lands or really constricted and cut off from their traditional food ways as Palestinians have
been. And I think another thing to connect it to the very earliest part of this conversation, what you were talking about, Amanda, with Amanda Cohen's piece about why mainstream media does not write about women chefs, period. It's about how do we hold press accountable, more accountable than we do, and how do we turn them into advocates and allies, and also instead of us doing all of the work to do that, how do we get them to wise up to do that?
Right, and also...
Or how did they, want to do that themselves?
Would love to, hear Amani and Aura's thought on, and really going back and understanding the media behind, quote unquote, food trends and why certain things have become trendy and why people want to write about Israeli food as we know it, and how can we, as people that have a small voice and a small audience, reframe that and understanding the process of how things become trends and how we can, reconfigure that. Why do you think Israeli food is having a moment of being trendy now?
I think it really fits into the current cultural paradigm of this really beautiful, healthy, fresh, ingredient-oriented, farm-to-table thing that we all like, or that people like and associate with being healthful and associate with being responsible socially. Obviously, Israeli food has a darker side where, as Aura was mentioning, the Round Tables initiative that Israel and American Express put on that encourages chefs from all over the world to come and cook farm-to-table cuisine in these very gastronomically advanced, metropolitan kitchens of Tel Aviv, which is also, pushed as this beautiful, exciting city where you can be whoever you want to be in it. And it's very similar to New York or wherever. I mean, I've never actually been to Tel Aviv because that's, a choice, but I've never really spent time in Israel at all other than going through the airport. But so I can only kind of speculate on why people like it so much. But I hear from people that go there that when they go there, they experience this beautiful place. So I think people associate this beautiful, exciting place with this beautiful, exciting cuisine. And then it's also exotic in a way, even though it's exotic within an arm's reach. Like, it's exotic, but it's not too exotic that it's inaccessible. And it's not, the flavors are flavors that maybe we've had in different ways and other types of food, but they're not so spicy that we can't access them and can't eat them. And they're not super weird ingredients. It's all pretty relatable, but presented in this way that's beautiful and delicious and exciting. And to me, I think that's why Israeli food is becoming so popular. I don't know. What do you think, Aura?
I mean, I think that it has a lot to do with that, translating process. And that's kind of what you're talking about, Amani, is, I'll just take a really concrete example, which I was emailing you guys about before. This we see everywhere in the U.S., Israeli couscous. And it's a term that has been coined that claims a food that so many different cultures eat some version of.
Shall we call it something else starting right for the sake of our conversation here?
Well, my proposal was transcultural multi-historical couscous, it's pearled wheat balls.
And pearled balls.
Yeah, Palestinians have maftul, and, Southern Italians have, there's acini de pepe and there's fregola. I mean, Hungarians have a version, Iranians have a version, Lebanese have a version. So that just shows it's there's this branding that happens that just erases all of this, kind of transcultural culinary and, sharing.
I think that's something that's really important for me to address, which is that I do think that all cultures are melting pots of the cultures that comprise them.
Yeah, there's no purity.
It's not like Israeli couscous was just something that someone came up with in the lab in the 1950s and was hell yeah, this is Israeli couscous. no, it's a thing that developed by way of a lot of different people making a version of it. So to put this label on it that isolates it from everything that preceded it is mm-hmm. so strange to me. Mm-hmm. It's very strange.
And I think that actually speaks to, Amanda, the trend question. What I thought of when you said that is there's this, it's just a treating food as a commodity and nothing mm-hmm. else. It's a commodification mm-hmm. mentality. Mm-hmm. So it's like, of course, people are only thinking in trends if they're only thinking of relating to food and culture through transactions. Mm-hmm. And I think that, so then it's like a product mm-hmm. divorced of its cultural and historical context. And actually, that reminds me of one of the dishes that's on the menu. You were saying, Imani, why you chose to do to use a dish with frika, mm-hmm. which is also kind of hot whole grain.
It's the hot grain du jour, I would say. It's on the up and up.
Tell us more about this hot green meat.
It's so sexy. I grew up eating frika in like probably the most like peasant like form, which is like a goopy stew with chicken. Yeah. And
I want some right now.
It's really great. But I'm gonna make a version of that as I recall eating it. But that's like how I grew up eating it. And now here I see it on menus all the time and it's presented in different forms and it doesn't look the same. Like it's not green a lot of the times. Like the way that they harvest it is by burning the wheat and then rubbing off all the chaff. And then there's just like the cracked green, beautiful. It's like, it almost looks like jade, like bamboo rice. Mm. It's really, really nice, chewy, delicious. Mm. But I wanted to make that just so that I could present it in the form that I know to be the way to cook it. Not that you can't make it other ways, because you obviously can, but that's the way that's authentic in my experience.
And for me, like, I have a connection to the foods of that land. And also, of course, like, Jewish culture contains many, many cultures. It's just, you know, it falls in line with a lot of the problems we're talking about also in terms of, you know, being presented as really Eurocentric and all these things. But there are many, many cultures that have formed kind of the collective Jewish consciousness. And for me, one of the exciting things about getting to work with Reem and Imani in presenting these dinners is the reason why actually one of the producers, the Jewish Voice for Peace, which is the fastest growing Jewish organization in the U.S., why they're supporting it is because for us it's about de-linking Jewishness with this unequivocal nationalist support of the state of Israel as the Jewish state trying to represent us. When we're like, that does not represent us. And we can feel a love of and connection to all these different elements of history and culture, including food and even place, like places like Jerusalem, without needing to dominate them and destroy everyone in our path, you know? Right. And so it's really exciting to be able to de-link my identity from that like colonial project and instead just work with the original peoples of that land to celebrate the sustainable traditional methods of growing, harvesting, and preparing food that are being destroyed by occupation.
Yeah, I mean, we've talked about this as well, that nothing exists in a vacuum. Food certainly does not. And recognizing indigenous folks, recognizing credit where credit is due, recognizing history and deep time is a real thing. But it becomes harder and harder to do that and to bring it back to media, because we are food media. Your resident food media analysts here. I think part of it is, and Amanda, we've talked about this as well, and I talked about this a bit when I did a talk on cultural appropriation a couple weeks ago, is sort of in our consumption of food and how we do it. Snaps through social media, how we do it in a sort of way where people treat dining out or eating out as a blood sport and a way to collect restaurants, mm-hmm. collect experiences. Mm-hmm. That again sort of emphasizes the food as a commodity and experience as a commodity.
It's like culinary conquistadors.
And divorcing ourselves from the origin stories of where food comes from. And just.
But also, you know, I used to be a reporter, and since I stopped being a reporter, how news travels and the way media needs to keep up with the content churn has just gotten more and more intense, shall we say. And you always need a new story. And people love trends. People are just trying to get clicks.
Actually, speaking of trends, one of the things...
I'm so glad I brought up trends.
I'm so ready to talk about that, Amanda. One of the other chef organizers who's joining us for the second dinner, the one at Lalito, which is going to include a dynamic dinner conversation. Actually, just want to, in terms of giving credit where credit is due, we were inspired by some of the programming at Food Book Fair this past spring.
Shout out Food Book Fair 2017.
For ways to have like... meaningful conversation and awesome food. But Neftali Duran, who's an indigenous Oaxacan chef, is a part of the I Collective, which is hosting actually a series of indigenous pre-colonial cuisine pop-ups on and around Thanksgiving in NYC.
At Dimes.
And Pixie and the Scout in Brooklyn. And he's going to be a part of our conversation. And for him, like, he actually sent me this little text earlier because I was like, what do you have to say to your adoring fans?
Yeah.
You know, and he was like, for me, the inequalities I see in the food system dramatically affect indigenous and people of color negatively, whether we're talking about the barrio, the res, or Palestine.
Mm.
So he's looking to make those connections. And why trends as a topic made me think of that is because we see these little openings in mainstream food media being where there's an interest in indigenous foodways. It's really important, and it's an opening that we can then kind of maybe bust open even wider. And because still sometimes, like what you're saying, Kim, is like the dynamic is still kind of acquisitional, you know? So it's like, I got to get my points. I got to, it's still kind of a explorer lens a lot of the time. I'm having so many wardrobe issues with my headphones. Thank God for you, Amanda. but then also, like, the thing is, if you're not actually figuring out ways to support Native producers, you know, so that they're able to own and benefit from their own traditional foodways, and instead you're just like incorporating indigenous foods into your menus that aren't in any way going back to those communities, then you're not actually transforming our society, sorry to say.
I think we should come up with a better word for trend in terms of popularizing and recognizing foodways and food practices and foodstuffs connected to history in multiple cultures. But perhaps we'll have to do that over the commercial break for Heritage Radio Network so we can support our hosts. All of our hosts here, the producers, engineers, and the family of radio folks that keep us on air.
Yeah, we'll be back after a short break, but just wanted to give everyone the website for information about the asymmetrical table. It's theasymmetricaltable.info. So please look at that and take a look at the upcoming dinners in New York and information beyond that. So we'll be back shortly.
Today's program is proudly brought to you by Whole Foods Market. Whole Foods Market believes in seeking out local, fresh, and seasonal food, and in supporting local farmers, makers, and the community as a whole, economically and agriculturally. Whole Foods Market believes in food that is vivid and colorful, fresh and full of nutrients. Food that connects you to your body, the seasons, and to nature. Food that helps you do more, sleep better, and wake up happier. Found in over 400 locations throughout the United States, Whole Foods Market only sells food that meets their standards, which means no artificial colors, flavors, preservatives, or sweeteners, ever. Whole Foods Market believes in real food. Visit wholefoodsmarket.com or download the Whole Foods Market app to learn more.
Welcome back. This is Recommended Reading with Food Book Fair. We are joined in the studio by Amani Ahmad, chef, and also Aura Wise, another amazing, talented chef. And they're here with us discussing the asymmetrical table. You can check out the asymmetricaltable.info and the dinners that they're hosting in New York as part of this project. So, Amani, tell us a little bit about the table. Tell us a little bit about the name.
I would love to tell you about the table. It's asymmetrical.
Yeah.
It's asymmetrical table.
Tell us.
Well, the impetus for doing these dinners was the thing I mentioned earlier, the round tables initiative, culinary project that serves to bring gastronomical diversity to Tel Aviv. And Aura was actually the one that informed me about it, and we had a little powwow and chatted and thought that it would be fun to do these dinners that reframed the conversation and were kind of a positive aside to something that I don't feel that positive about. But when we were naming it, I thought that the asymmetrical table was a very succinct way to talk about how the conversation isn't very round. It's not very even. It's not very accommodating for all sides, on all levels, from food to human rights to everything, pretty much. Like, there's not really a lot of equanimity involved with that. So that's why I wanted to call it the asymmetrical table. Also happens to be the way that the tables are shaped at Dimes, where we will be doing the dinner on the 13th. They're all these beautiful candy-colored different shaped tables. It was a lovely accident.
Shout out to our boo Sabrina.
Shout out to that genius. So that's why it's very appropriate.
And can you give us a little bit of a preview of the menu that you and Reem Asil from Reem's California have been putting together? I've gotten a little bit of a hint via many back and forth emails, and I just get hungrier and hungrier.
It's an exclusive preview here.
You heard it here first.
It's true. Well, I think one of my favorite things on the menu is possibly the most simple, basic thing, but it's so emblematic of Palestinian food specifically, and it's something you've probably had in different, in different forms, za'atar, but it's zeit and za'atar, which is oil, olive oil, Palestinian olive oil specifically, and za'atar, which is za'atar ground up, mixed with sesame seeds, and it's two little dishes. It'll be served with warm, fresh-made pita that Reem will be making. She is a very talented baker, something that I don't really have in my repertoire, but she can hold that. Not yet, but she can hold that down. But it's a really simple starter of just taking this warm, delicious pita bread and ripping off pieces and dipping it in the oil and then dipping it in the za'atar. And that's like so quintessential to me. Like, that's something I would eat as a snack. That's something I would eat for breakfast. I would eat that for, I would just eat it whenever. It's so good and tangy and so specifically Palestinian to me. I'm sure other Middle Eastern countries also do that, but to me, it really feels Palestinian. It's a way that, again, like similar with the frika, it's the pure way that I've experienced that. And it's different than a lot of places here where maybe put za'atar like on a pita with olive oil and make it into like a little pizza or something like that. It's like just kind of, it's more primary form.
That's really beautiful. And I think we definitely recommend, as our recommended reading, by the way, that everyone check out the essay that you wrote which is at the asymmetricaltable.info, which was on the back of all the menus at Dimes during the first go-round where you did your pop-up, where you speak so eloquently and straightforwardly.
Thank you.
Really, this is really, I think this is something that sort of stuck with me after that dinner, and it's remarkable to have you in here in studio as well, speaking live in real time in the same way, how you speak about... And this, I can't help but think about this when you talk about the menu, about olive oil and the Palestinian farmers not having access to olive groves or having them destroyed. And then the za'atar that you talk about, that you talked about early on in the show, how your family for generations has foraged for and now is not able to sort of, whether people know when they're eating it, whether they just think of this as beautiful, primary, delicious, primal sensation, the sensual experience, or whether they know of that deeper meaning. I think there's something, definitely something there.
Yeah. I mean, yeah.
And then also the menu is split, kind of. It's a combining.
Yeah, that was something I really wanted to do because it kind of resonates with the situation there. I mean, I've never been to Gaza. I grew up in Utah and in the West Bank, and I've never been to Gaza, and I really wanted to collaborate with Reem because she's a Gazan chef, and I wanted to kind of highlight the disparity in cuisine between the two regions that are as a result of just the borders and what there's access to. She's making a fish dish for the Maine, which I've never even had a Palestinian fish dish because we don't have access to fish in the West Bank.
That's deep.
Yeah.
And it's not that far away.
It's
from
not.
The sea.
It's a very tiny place in this region. It's
they
very
just
small.
You can't get through.
Yeah. You can't get through, and, you know, people from Gaza can't get out. Originally, when we talked about doing these dinners, Ora and I talked about having a chef from each part of the Palestinian factions. There's the Gaza, the West Bank, and Jerusalem, because what a lot of people don't know is that in Palestine there's different identification cards that people hold from each region, and you're only allowed to exist within the space that your identification card claims you as. So if you're from Gaza, you can only be in Gaza. If you're from the West Bank, you can only be in the West Bank. And if you're from Jerusalem, you can only be in Jerusalem. Obviously there's like special permits and you know, visas you can get to go to Jerusalem, but most people in my family are not allowed to go to Jerusalem, which is a place where my mother went to high school. But now when we go there, she has to apply for a visa. We can advance just so we can go for the day. So I wanted to highlight how having these separations between people that are not very different has really affected what they cook and what they have access to and how they've adapted to make these recipes that are traditional in slightly different ways because of what they have.
It's also awesome because I think it shows that on the positive side, it shows the like rich diversity of Palestinian culture and
cuisine.
The
resiliency.
Yeah, because there are people who are often not only represented as one monolithic people, but are actually one represented as one monolithic bad guy, right? You know, in Western media for sure. So it's like not only are people learning about Palestinians from a different angle, from sitting in a different maybe angle of the table, but also getting to see the diversity and richness, Kim, and resilience. And also actually technically we at least have 48 represented because Reem's like grandmother is from Yafo, which is within Palestine 48, which became the state of Israel, where there are also Palestinians who those who remain managed to remain on the land became then second class citizens within Israel and are restricted and, you know, in all kinds of other ways. So there's all these separations that then Reem and Amani are breaking down the barriers between each other and coming together.
What has it been like to work together so far?
Well, I haven't met
mostly
her yet.
Remotely, I know. But
You know, we have some emails. They're really fun. no, it's been nice. It's been interesting. I've never collaborated with another Palestinian person, especially not on food, aside from like my mom or my grandma or my aunts when we're all sitting around rolling grape leaves. But that's very different because this is, I don't know. It's really interesting and exciting. Another female chef who's very independent and empowered and also very interested in these same issues.
And can you talk a little bit about how you came to cook Palestinian food as part of your public life?
Oh.
I think a lot of people probably know you as an artist, first and foremost.
Yeah. I think I've always liked cooking, and I've always been very exploratory with my own cooking and eating, and I was raised with parents that loved to cook. But I first cooked Palestinian food as part of my practice for my senior exhibition at Cooper Union. And at the time, I didn't even really realize what I was doing. And I actually made my mom cook most of the food because I was making other stuff. Thanks, Mom. But that was the first time I came to do it, because it just seemed like a really important part of my identity that I needed to address. As someone that's grown up in a very non-traditional Palestinian way, but in, you know, living in New York for the last 9 years, growing up in Salt Lake City, being in the West Bank, going back and forth, and not ever feeling, you know, fully Palestinian or fully American, it was important for me to discuss that and discuss the ubiquity of, like, that experience and, like, share these flavors and share, you know, one of my favorite things in that first Palestinian meal was bringing, like, these tiered baskets of green almonds to share with everyone, because no one had ever had these, but these were just like a snack that I liked to eat as a kid, and they're so interesting and fun and exotic. I think food, especially in this context, is a really appropriate and disarming way to talk about larger issues. And I think it's, you know, for me, I approach activism in a maybe like a subtle way, where I'm not, you know, maybe always out there waving banners or holding signs or whatever, but I find that it's easier for me to talk about things with other people if I feel like I'm doing it in a way that they don't feel disarmed by or armed by, rather, where they feel comfortable and they can understand it, and it doesn't become an issue of religion or whatever it is that people get bristled about. But we can just talk about food because everyone likes food, and you need food, and you want food, and it's delicious, and it's great, and it can be evocative in so many ways.
I love how you put it that way. I think I've certainly read a number of stories about food in the greater Middle East, and I'll put all of those words I just said in scare quotes. Where there's always a quotation where someone says, but can't hummus bring us together? Or, but of course food is the common denominator. Or food will, you know, we can have that hope that food is what's going to solve the Israeli-Palestinian conflict. Which is, I feel, to the reader, sort of insulting. But I think your framing of it as it using it as a assertive tool is a really beautiful way of talking about it.
Yeah, and it's not, because a lot of the time what you're talking about, Kim, is like representing as some like frivolous squabble.
Yeah.
Right? And like, yeah, it is insulting.
It's like, oh, no one invented hummus.
Yeah,
like,
why are they fighting over it? They're just like fighting over it. It's so frivolous. And it's like, no, actually, people are fighting for their lives, actually. And to be able to, you know, eat what they need to eat and actually also live in a home and on a land.
Right.
And so, but it doesn't mean why, like, Amani and Reem both are just such powerful change makers and artists, is that, because it doesn't mean then that it has to be negative. It can be this evocative, powerful tool. They're both creating really positive spaces, not just for themselves and other Palestinians, but for all of us, you know, like Reem's in Oakland is a place where, like, all my friends go and hang out and have a beautiful space to be in. They've also all had to mobilize to, like, support Reem as really racist Zionist organizations have staged protests outside and Yelp attacks and all these things, this, like, intense backlash. And so, but that is, like, they don't let it stop them from it being, like, this is a positive cultural space for us.
Right. I think part of it in larger conversations that people of color have and communities of color and indigenous communities have about just connected to food and cultural appropriation, which of course is connected to larger conversations about the economic appropriation that allows cultural appropriation to happen, and the larger, if we are going to reframe it, struggle for sovereignty and resiliency for everybody all over this planet, is sometimes it's like, shit, we're already trying to survive here. Can we just have zaatar? Can we just have sinigang? Can we just have collard greens? Don't take this from us, too, kind of thing.
That the privileged folks get upset.
Yeah.
They have to think too hard. It's too much thinking.
Well, yeah,
but we're saying sure you can enjoy them and help us enjoy
just
them.
Think
and come,
a
to
more.
Our asymmetrical
think a
table.
More. Yeah. Come to our asymmetrical table.
So
enjoy the food.
Speaking of asymmetrical table, again, the info is the asymmetrical table
.info.
And if you're in New York, the dinners will be held on Monday the 13th at Dimes and Tuesday the 14th at Lalito. And Lalito will also include a discussion portion prior alongside the dinner, as I'm sure the women in the room have organized so beautifully.
We're going to do that over pizza.
Oh, gotcha. So please join them. And thank you so much for listening. And thank you so much to Omani and Aura for being here with us and sharing so much knowledge with us.
Just a little bit of a note on that dinner dialogue.
Yes.
It's going to be a panel discussion moderated by Clancy Miller, who is an amazing chef and cookbook author and participant in Food Book Fair 2017, and including other speakers, Aura, Neftali Duran, who we mentioned earlier, Reem and Amani will be speaking as well. I will be doing the introduction and very honored to be doing that, and we're very happy to be supporting all of this work that we're doing together.
You guys are amazing.
Thank you for
having us and supporting this.
We'll be here to fight white supremacy and the cis hetero patriarchy on the radio any chance we get.
It was really our pleasure to have you both, and thank you.
Thank you.
So it's the asymmetricaltable.info. You can also find out more information. We did a couple posts about it at Food Book Fair on Instagram and Twitter. You just follow the links in there. And we hope to see you if you're in New York next Monday and Tuesday.
See you there.
Thanks.
Thanks for listening to Heritage Radio Network. Food radio supported by you. For our freshest content and to hear about exclusive events, subscribe to our newsletter. Enter your email at the bottom of our website, heritageradionetwork.org. Connect with us on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter at heritage_radio. Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization driving conversations to make the world a better, fairer, more delicious place. And we couldn't do it without support from listeners like you. Want to be a part of the food world's most innovative community? Rate the shows you like, tell your friends, and please join our community by becoming a member. Just click on the beating heart at the top right of our homepage. Thanks for listening.
Recommended reading is powered by Simplecast. Simplecast is a popular hosting and analytics platform that allows podcasters to easily host and publish to apps like Apple Podcasts. If you have a podcast or are looking to create your very first, check it out. Try it for free and save half off your first 3 months at simplecast.com/heritage.
Hey, everybody, I'm Nick Layton.
And I'm Leah Bonema.
And we're the hosts of Were You Raised by Wolves?
Each week, we try to make the world a kinder, nicer place.
Well, that's the idea, at least.
I mean, we try.
Have you ever wondered what to do if you're ghosted?
Or what to do when a friend asks you to borrow money?
Or the proper way to eat Cheetos?
You know, the big questions.
So please find Were You Raised by Wolves wherever you listen.